Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A part of that war that has largely been unknown, let alone adequately understood, is the role that the process of evaluating the backgrounds of individuals in government, usually, or otherwise involved in handling sensitive, often classified information, plays in assuring the effectiveness of the workings of government. A man who understands this very well is our first guest. He is Sean Bigley. He is a national security attorney and managing partner of Bigley Rainish, LLP. Interestingly enough, he has a background as a former federal background investigator for the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, OPM. He has written several important pieces, including Will Attorneys Now Raise the Hillary Defense on Classified Information in the National Interest and the Impact of Criminal Charges on Federal Security Clearances. That was in the California Journal of Criminal Law. He has also written very prominently in the past week a very, very troubling essay in the Wall Street Journal entitled "The Deep State Weaponizes Vetting of Trump Appointees." And he talks about a client of his, a gentleman by the name of Adam Lovinger, who I have had the privilege of meeting and but admired for a long time, who has been royally screwed, I think is the technical term for it, by this vetting process or background investigations, the weaponized use of clearances. So good to have you, Sean Bigley. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank.
So just give us, through the prism of what's been going on with Adam, an insight into what is happening with respect to the Trump administration more generally.
Sure. Well, in the case of Mr. Lovinger in particular, this is a battle we've been unfortunately fighting for a year now. Essentially, a little bit of background here. Mr. Lovinger is a longtime DOD official. He's fairly senior and very well respected in the field of strategy. And early in the Trump administration, he caught the attention of those in the White House who decided that his views were very much in line with the president's, and his expertise was something that they wanted to have in the administration. So they reached out and sort of plucked him from the Pentagon and brought him over to the White House. That was something that unfortunately was not well received in the bureaucracy over at the Pentagon, who decided essentially that a way to sort of cut that off and neuter him, if you will, would be to just, you know, take his security clearance on some really ridiculous and specious grounds.
Now, just to be clear, Sean, this is a clearance that he has had for years. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. He's had it for about 13 years, never had a problem. And, you know, suddenly the Trump administration comes in, he starts getting some attention, and magically his clearance gets taken away.
Is it fair to say it was taken away by Obama holdovers?
Absolutely. And that's precisely who we're fighting over there right now. There are some very senior, entrenched bureaucrats who are Obama-era holdovers still in the Pentagon who are really gumming up the works. And, you know, the interesting part of all this is Mr. Lovinger is also a whistleblower. And so you have really two kind of overlapping elements here, or themes, if you will, underlying the security clearance revocation. One being the fact that these folks over at the Pentagon, you know, dislike Trump. They dislike anybody who's going to be, you know, effectively carrying out his agenda. And then secondly, they dislike anybody who's going to blow the whistle on the corruption and the cronyism and contracting that's going on over there. And there's a lot of problems with that. There's tremendous waste and abuse in certain offices of the Pentagon. And Mr. Lovinger was exposing that. He was kind of rooting that out before he was transitioning over to the White House.
So to the extent that this is, in microcosm, evidence of a larger problem, how would you characterize that larger problem, Sean Bigley, at the moment with respect to this weaponization of the clearances inside the Trump administration? What effect is it having?
Yeah, this case is absolutely symptomatic of the larger problem. And, you know, it is a problem that we're seeing over and over again across every agency. We're even seeing it now at the cabinet level. I mean, you just look at the recent issues with Ronnie Jackson and the VA. I mean, they essentially just throw whatever they think can stick against the wall. There's no effort to verify it. There's no effort to, you know, ask basic questions before they hurl out allegations and publicly smear someone. And, you know, the point that I've been trying to make to a lot of people is, there's an old saying that policy is people. And I think what the bureaucracy and the folks who are just determined to thwart the president's agenda have figured out is that the easiest way to do that is to prevent people from coming into the bureaucracy who will faithfully execute the president's agenda. In other words, they can't stop the president's policy, but they can stop the people who will implement it. And that is precisely what they are doing.
Yeah. And the practical effect, unfortunately, in time after time is actually undermining, if not completely sabotaging, that policy as well. You've got a wealth of experience, obviously, going back to your days as a background investigator yourself. This is a subject, I hope, for another longer visit with you if we can, Sean Bigley, but I just would ask you very quickly, could you characterize how well the larger process of evaluating people for clearances, the background investigation process, if you will, is working in the United States government today? In the past, I know there have been immense backlogs of these investigations, some of which, as I understand it, were simply flushed, as they say, by the contractors who were responsible for performing the investigations, which is to say they didn't do them, they just said they had. How would you characterize how things are working in that regard?
Well, in short, I would characterize it as a nightmare. I mean, to be frank with you, we've had people who are sitting in this quagmire for up to 24 months, and it's amazing that anything gets done. It's terrible. It's affecting industry in particular, you know, contracting in the aviation world and in the defense community. You have a tremendous backlog there. And, you know, these are real problems. They're affecting people's lives. They're affecting people's livelihood, their ability to put food on the table. And I think there needs to be some real attention paid to this issue. I think that we're starting to see a little bit of traction on Capitol Hill with folks who are finally, you know, paying attention to this. But there's a lot more to be done. And there's a lot of reform that needs to happen that frankly, is long overdue.
Yeah. And when you say affecting their livelihoods, obviously that has some bearing on whether people are willing to put themselves through all of this in order to perform really vital missions, whether it's inside the government or whether it's, as you say, in the supporting industries and the defense sector and so on. Adam Lovinger is a case study of miscarriages of justice in this regard. I know there are many more, and we'll look forward to exploring them with you on another occasion soon. Sean Bigley, I appreciate very much your time with us today and for the work you're doing at Bigley Ranish on Adam's behalf, among others, for the good of our country. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Rick Manning. We'll do a bit of a deeper dive on what the deep state is up to right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by a good friend and much admired colleague, Richard Manning, the president of Americans for Limited Government. He formerly served in the George W. Bush administration as the chief of public affairs at the U.S. Department of Labor for 9 years. He worked for the National Rifle Association, which had a big weekend last weekend in Dallas as a state lobbyist. He writes these days brilliantly and frequently in places like The Hill and FoxNews.com, and most recently, I believe, at The Daily Caller. Indeed, he wrote a piece entitled Coup by Intimidation, The Swamp fights back. Rick Manning, it's great to have you with us. We were just talking about one manifestation of the swamp fighting back with Sean Bigley, Adam Lovinger's lawyer, who wrote about the weaponization of clearances by the state, the deep state, against the Trump administration. You've been doing some serious thinking about other ways in which this kind of coup, as you call it, is manifesting itself. Tell us about them.
Yes, Frank. This has been going on a long time, but there are three stories which came out late last week, which really crystallized a few things for me. The first story headlined was House Democrat warns Trump team, you'll end up sullied like Ronnie Jackson. Ronnie Jackson being the president's former physician who was going to be nominated for VA secretary and got smeared in the process by some really unsavory things that people like Senator John Tester from Montana raised that were completely made up. But it didn't matter because he was working for Trump. So obviously he was a bad guy. Second article was ex-Trump aide Michael Caputo warns investigations espousing punishment strategy to deter future Trump-led candidates. Caputo bring in this same day, Caputo, who was a campaign worker for Trump, says he's had to undergo $150,000 of legal fees, putting his family in jeopardy, and sell his house, all because he worked for Trump and defending himself against charges that didn't really even exist. But because he campaigned for Trump, he was subjected, his life was ruined. So we have a guy who worked for Trump in the administration, whose life was ruined because Trump appointed him to the VA secretary. We have somebody who worked for Trump's campaign whose life was ruined simply because he worked for the campaign. And then the third article was talking about how the FBI had tapped Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's phones prior to their raiding his offices and had picked up calls from the White House, showing that the federal government itself was engaged in listening in on Trump's personal attorney's calls in an attempt to find anything they could find on Trump or anybody around him. So, Frank, here's the bottom line on it. And this is why I wrote a title, Coup by Intimidation. If you work for the United States of America and under the Trump administration, the left is going to smear you and try to destroy you. If you work for the Trump campaign or anybody associated with the Trump campaign, the left is going to attack you and attempt to smear you. And if you actually have a client relationship with Donald Trump on a third level, the FBI is going to try to smear you. This is such an extreme attack on our basic capacity to engage in democracy and actually governance, that it's beyond the pale of anything I think our country's ever seen. The left has determined and is pushing an agenda where anybody who has anything to do with Donald Trump is guilty until proven innocent and will be destroyed, not through anything they've done wrong, but simply by going and putting them through a legal process that destroys their capacity to make a living and destroys their capacity to actually keep the stuff that they've made over the course of a lifetime, destroys the capacity of a guy like Michael Caputo to be able to even have his child have an education fund because he had to use the education fund to keep himself out of jail given the threats were made.
Yeah, this really ties in with what we were just talking about with Sean Bigley, who was recounting the horrors that Adam Lovinger, a Defense Department official who had been brought into the National Security Council early in the administration, has been going through since, you know, he was targeted by the deep state for blocking his work at the NSC by taking away his security clearance. So it's lots of different techniques that are being used. The common denominator, though, is, as Sean pointed out, if personnel is policy, this is a way to decisively defeat the president's policies. If you can't do it at the poll, do it by sabotaging the administration through investigations and, you know, criminal proceedings and just character assassination and harassment. Let me ask you, in light of all of that, we are watching the growing dissatisfaction, Rick Manning, of an awful lot of Americans with what they're seeing in Washington, specifically the failure to drain the swamp, something that not only the president promised to do, but members of Congress, I think, were also campaigning for last year. The swamp is, as we've just been discussing, undeniably undrained at the moment, arguably is filling to the brim. When you look at all of this, what role do you think the Republican congressional leadership has played in perpetuating the swamp, tolerating this kind of behavior, and thereby contributing to the undermining of the president's agenda?
At best, they have been willfully ignorant, blind to what's been going on, and have allowed it to occur, assuming that the game is still being played the way it's always been played, and that there's not an ongoing effort within the government itself to deny the Trump administration the capacity to actually have an administration. That's the most charitable piece of it. They have not aggressively supported the president on these matters. They have not taken it into their own hands to go after the left and the administration. And they have some tools at their disposal that they have not utilized to do so. But on the Senate side, I think the fact that the Senate, has worked about 2.5 days a week on nominations in the first year of the Trump presidency, and we have about half of the Trump nominees that have to be confirmed by the Senate still not confirmed. People like Eric Dryband at the Office of Civil Rights at the Justice Department sitting there languishing because a Republican senator has put a hold on his nomination over his concern about pot policies. The Republicans are sitting there acting as though this is a Democratic administration that they're seeking to obstruct, and the Democrats have been doing everything they can to stop the Trump administration from getting into gear, and it is obscene what's happened in terms of both the Senate and the House, and they need to get on the stick.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, you are also aware of something that's going on in parallel with all of this. It's not exactly the deep state, because it's operating in the private sector. It's the deep IT, I guess you might call it, the monopolies of the big internet companies that are now increasingly engaged in activities. I had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Robert Epstein about this last week. Surveillance, censorship, and manipulation. That is in cahoots often with the Southern Poverty Law Center being used to target, in really political warfare terms, target people, including, I think, the president and his team, as well as many of us on the outside. What would your counsel be about how to contend with that political front in this war as well?
That is probably the hardest piece of this to confront. It's multifaceted, as you know, but places like Facebook, Google, Twitter also operate internationally, and they make agreements with people like the EU that they're going to abide by EU rules related to so-called hate speech. And in doing so, they justify using their company dominance in the field to determine what they become the arbiters of what hate speech is. And they've selected people who are actually at the forefront of hate speech, of intolerance, of gross disregard for basic First Amendment rights. SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, as their arbiters, as their independent arbiters. And as a result, we have a real problem. There's multiple different answers. None of them are easy. One is, for purposes of speech, treating those companies as if they are government entities and protecting First Amendment rights on their platforms. They have certain advantages because they claim to be a platform rather than an advocate. and under the law. And by changing that and making it so they have to choose as to whether simply be a neutral platform or be an advocate, they could lose some advantage, get some legal disadvantages if they choose to be an advocate, which they are choosing to do now. That would be one. Two, you could break them up. You could break up Google. You force YouTube separate from Google. You can take Instagram away from Facebook. Those are things that DOJ can do. That's a 3 to 5 year problem. And 3 to 5 years, the problem's probably so far gone that we can't win. And then the last thing is there's been some talk of that I'm not a big advocate of, but there's some talk of declaring them to be a national utility and effectively taking away, by making them a national utility, subjecting them to First Amendment requirements under their laws. The problem with that is that if the Democrats take over, the wrong combination, Republicans and Democrats take over, that national utility will be used to restrict freedom rather than expand it.
Yeah. As is being done in Europe right now, as a matter of fact. Always appreciate your time with us. Rick Manning at Americans for Limited Government, and come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Joined, it is my delight to say, by a man I've come to admire tremendously for his acumen about what I think of as the war for the free world, and his ability to discuss it and inform the rest of us about both the magnitude of the threat we're facing, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, the existential threat to freedom that we are facing, and the stakes, if we do not rise as previous generations have done and as President Reagan exhorted us to do, to it in our time. He is Daniel Greenfield. He is the Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. You can find him blogging at Sultan Knish and writing extensively at the Freedom Center's Front Page magazine, among other outlets. He is an extraordinary intellect and resource and colleague and friend, and I'm delighted to have him with us always. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
I'm very honored to be here again.
So, given that you've got a sense of what the whole elephant looks like, Daniel, and that the rest of us spend a lot of time talking about the trunk or talking about a leg here or a tail there, could you just characterize, as you see it, the nature of the war we're in, this war for the free world, if you will?
Well, I like to talk about it in terms of vertical integration. We think of the various powers as operating horizontally, but in reality, the powers that we're dealing with are not bounded by nations. That's really the fundamental definition, the difference between our side and their side, I would argue. We think in terms of the nation state. They don't think in terms of the nation state. They think in terms of ideology. So Islamic ideology is obviously the uniting point between the various factions of Islam. It made the Islamic conquest possible because you took a bunch of different warlords and you united them all around the idea, the Islamic idea. Obviously, that didn't hold up entirely, and there's all sorts of internal conflicts that continue to this day. And you have something similar on the left, a unity that is transnational. It transcends individual borders. It transcends individual nations. It's a unity around an ideology. So, for example, when John Kerry goes out and he conducts his covert diplomacy, so to speak, with Iran, with the PLO, he's not representing the United States. I mean, it's obviously illegal under the Logan Act for somebody to be doing that. He's representing the left. He's representing the larger ideological position and its outreach to the Islamic sphere. And that's the kind of diplomacy we've been seeing between the red and the green. A diplomacy that is ideological. It's between two ideological movements that are transnational.
That may not have the same end state in mind, needless to say, but are perfectly prepared to make common cause against what they consider to be their mutual foe, namely, well, Western civ, and certainly our constitutional republic. Would you agree?
Absolutely. That is exactly what's going on. Their goal was to destroy the nation state, to destroy individual constitutional entities and replace them with an ideological movement. Which ideological movement it will be is up for grabs. We've seen similar situations, obviously, in Iran, where the left allied with the Khomeinists, with the result, of course, that the forces of Islam eventually took over. Again, similar situation in Egypt during the Arab Spring, Tunisia, a number of other spaces where, again, the left collaborated with Islam, and the end result was that Islam proved to be triumphant. Certainly, Islam has a home court advantage in any Islamic population. We'll see what the results are like, and hopefully we don't see what the results are like in Europe, but hopefully we don't. But they're gambling that it's going to be the same outcome, and again, if they do achieve their demographic goals, then the end result will be the same. If you have migration that fundamentally transforms the populations of Europe, of Australia, of Canada, of the United States, then they will have once again the home court advantage, and the left is going to come away with nothing except a nice beheading.
Yeah. Daniel Greenfield, you have written extensively on these subjects and have thought, as I say, very, very rigorously about them. Most of the rest of us honestly don't seem to have even given it a passing thought, let alone appreciate the magnitude of the peril we're facing. This is being compounded, it seems to me, this ignorance, this willful blindness, as Andy calls it, that the censorship that is one of the trademark techniques of these ideologies, whether they're of the left or of the Islamist stripe, specifically insisting on, in the latter case, conformity with Sharia blasphemy laws, seem increasingly to be operating not just in Europe, but here as well, notably through the European Union's ability to extort, basically, though I'm not sure it's actually being resisted by the IT giants, but to extort them to conform to EU standards for so-called hate speech, even in their transactions here in the United States. Would you talk us through how significant this problem seems to you to be, and what, if anything, we might do about it?
If you think about really the defining feature of the United States and really a lot of the modern liberal republic, it was individualism, and that meant it was accompanied by freedom, individual freedom to do, to act, to speak. On the other hand, when you look at totalitarian movements, whether it's the left or the Islamic ones, they're collectivist movements, which means they have to organize and harmonize everybody. And to do that, obviously, you need to control speech, you need to control thought, you need to control people's expressions. So the left and the Islamists are very much on the same page in this regard. And the European Union has been very aggressively able to pressure companies into complying with their regulations. And this is the larger problem with the whole idea of the Internet, because we've had a lot of idealistic ideas about it. But the basic reality is you have an international space, and there are more people outside the United States than inside the United States, and there are far more countries that don't have free speech than do have free speech. Really, the United States is the only country that does have free speech. So if you have a public marketplace of ideas that is largely based outside the United States, even if the companies like Facebook are sort of technically headquartered in the United States, then they're going to eventually comply with those regulations. Companies that do business in China have to comply with Chinese ideas. And the European Union has been very aggressively pressuring Facebook, they've been pressuring Google into censoring speech. Now, in the European Union, this is far more acceptable than it is in the United States. To the extent that they have a free speech guarantee, it's basically conditioned on government interest. When the government feels it's in the interest to censor certain kinds of speech, that's perfectly acceptable. And, of course, the European Union has its own extensive history with what they call fascism. So, as a result, they have plenty of legal justifications for doing so. And to their way of thinking, you can't have a democratic system of any kind unless you control certain kinds of unacceptable speech. That's very far into the American idea. So we have this confrontation that's always been building. It's a confrontation between the European way of doing things and the American way of doing things. And when you add Islam in, we're talking about an ideology that has been very willing to engage in riots and terrorist attacks at speech that they don't like. And we've had this test to destruction with the Muhammad cartoons, where much of the American media very willingly gave in and refused to print them. There were actually European publications that were willing to do so. So you have two violent ideologies, both of them that are based around control and censorship. And we have the internet, which is an international medium, which means it's going to exist in Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's going to exist in Brussels. It's going to exist in London. It's going to exist in the United States. The question is, how can we protect our marketplace of ideas from censorship by the Europeans, by Islamists? And to do that, we actually have to remember what free speech is and what the value of it is. And we've been losing that as a society also.
We have. And I think you said earlier that, you know, we're the only nation that has free speech. Of course, there would be others who insist that they do. We're the only one that has had it guaranteed by our Constitution, is what I think you're getting at. And we are seemingly in considerable peril of losing that freedom, at least through this incremental garroting of it by the social media giants and the platforms they control, and the willingness of large numbers of particularly younger Americans who have been inculcated with the left's indoctrination, to some extent, the Islamists for that matter, so as to not give offense to anybody and therefore to restrict freedom of speech. Daniel Greenfield, to what extent is this a generational problem as much as it is the failure of us in our generation to attend to these things properly?
There's definitely a generational component. If you look at polls, the younger generation is much less supportive of free speech. That's to some extent campus and school indoctrination. It's hard to say what it would be like 10, 15 years down the road because people tend to mature in their politics. Now, when I say that America is the only country with free speech, it means that we're as uncompromising as it becomes when it comes to free speech. So the European Union, other countries tend to have a hate crime speech exception. Australia, for example, had free speech that was closer to our own, and then they had hate crime code. Now, in the United States, there's no such thing as hate crime exceptions to free speech. You can say, legally say racist things. The question is how long you'll be able to do that. And obviously, once upon a time, the ACLU would defend that idea because speech should be uncompromising, and if we censor somebody's speech for political reasons, we're going to end up censoring everybody's speech. And now this is something that the left is on board with. It's on board with the idea of censoring everybody's speech to protect the vulnerable populations. And this is the ideology that's being taught on campuses. It's the ideology that's at the heart of it. So you have a New York Times editorial, for example, that argues that certain kinds of free speech inflict actual physical measurable harm on vulnerable populations. Now, again, if you use that argument, you can effectively nullify speech. In the case of Islam, the argument has been obviously that when Muslims carry terrorist attacks in response to speech, it's the response. It's a kind of a felony murder situation. It's the fault of the person who issued the speech. And this is what we had with the Innocence of Muslims movie, where the guy who was behind the movie was blamed for Benghazi. Obviously, we don't need to go into all the things wrong with that particular line of argument. But this is what's been going on, and this is now going mainstream. So when Facebook is being increasingly pressured to comply with European Union ideas of hate speech, and they have an extensive blueprint now, which is around something like 60 pages defining just what hate speech is, which basically means that anything can be hate speech.
Your insights into all of these things, Daniel Greenfield, which you relay to us with regularity, thank goodness, at Front Page Magazine and elsewhere, are so appreciated and so valuable. And I hope that you will come back to us in the near future to discuss them further. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on in Asia right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia and American interests there. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast. He is a frequent guest at Fox News and other media outlets. We're always grateful that he takes some time to be on this one, as a matter of fact. He is also the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown: North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. As always, it's good to have you.
It's great to be here, Frank, so thank you.
Let me ask you first, Gordon, about the inauguration today for the fourth time of Vladimir Putin. Apparently, this is the longest-running reign in certainly recent history, going back to Stalin's time for a Russian leader, or for that matter, Soviet leader. We don't always think about Putin and his activities in Asia, but obviously it's a very big part of the Russian geography and foreign policy as well. Talk a little bit about what you make of the prospect of another 6 years minimum of Vladimir Putin.
Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, I'm sure is envious. You know, earlier this year in March, he got the National People's Congress to abolish the two-term limit for the presidency and vice presidency. That opens the door for him to actually rule indefinitely. And I think that he's looking at Putin as this model in that regard. But, you know, with regard to China and Russia in Asia, the other thing is that the Chinese and Russian militaries are working together closely. A couple of years ago, the two drilled together in the South China Sea in what the Xinhua News Agency, the official Chinese media outlet, called were island-seizing missions. And since then, they have been working together again in the South China Sea. So that's the thing that we've got to be concerned about. We not only have to deal with China, we have to deal perhaps with both the Chinese and the Russian armed forces at the same time.
Gordon, what I'm always astonished by, and I think we've discussed this in the past, but not recently, and I'd like to get your current thinking on it. It would seem as though the Russians and Chinese, not only historically, but prospectively, will be adversaries again, that they have, you know, a certain amount of resources and real estate that they're likely to decide the other has and they want. And I'm just wondering, as you see it, how does Vladimir Putin make not only these kinds of arrangements with the Chinese, cooperating with them, training with them, even selling them advanced weaponry, when there's a real prospect that all of that will be used against his own personnel and country in the future?
Well, I'm sure that long term, Putin and the Russians worry about the Chinese. But in the short term, and even in the intermediate term, they're working very closely together. So even where they compete, so for instance, in Central Asia, they're competing under the same framework, and they talk in terms of cooperation. And I think that's a real sign of partnership. So they are maturing their relationship. They are working together because Xi Jinping and Putin view the world in the same terms, Frank, and they identify the same adversary, which is the United States. And so in the time frame that we're concerned about, we might think in long term that they won't get along. But right now, they are getting along. They are opposing us. And we got to take it as a given that they are working together.
Yeah. Gordon, how does Russia see this One Belt, One Road initiative of the Chinese? Is there any concern that that is creating, in perhaps different circumstances, a colonial empire that will encircle and ultimately pose a challenge to Russian interests as well?
Long term, I'm sure the Russians think that way about Belt and Road, but short term, the Russians want Chinese money and they actively working to get it. And so they do have at least three Belt and Road projects together, and we can expect many more in the future.
Mm. There is, in other words, it seems in Vladimir Putin's mind, a kind of après moi le déluge quality to all of this, that the long term is somebody else's problem, even though he may be there for a very long time. Gordon, let me just address with you one other aspect of what is going on at the moment, of course, and that is the North Korean diplomatic dance. The president has indicated that he's got a place and a time set for this summit meeting with Kim Jong-un. He hasn't disclosed it yet. Presumably that will await the visit to Washington in another couple of weeks of the South Korean President Moon. What is the current view, as you see it, in Beijing of what's happening with respect to the United States and their proxy, North Korea?
The Chinese are alarmed that they are outside the talks. When President Trump accepted Kim Jong-un's offer on March 8th for direct discussions, it meant that China was going to be outside the room. And so since that time, Beijing is trying to make its presence felt. You just had the Chinese foreign minister in Pyongyang. Xi Jinping himself will go there next month. And that's a real effort to reassert control over the North Koreans. And indeed, you know, with the North Koreans, Frank, in the last couple of days, on Friday. There does seem to be some real concern in Pyongyang about the way things are going. And so we have seen some propaganda blasts against the United States. That's an indication that maybe the North Koreans feel that they have the Chinese at their back and that they can stand up to the United States in a more forthright way than they did, let's say, a couple of weeks ago.
Do you think that is also an indication that the Chinese are telling them to stand up to the United States, that this is being directed from China, without which, obviously, there would be no North Korean regime at all, right?
There's a one-word answer to your question, Frank, and that's yes.
Gordon, having said all of that, you went out on a rather sizable limb, it seemed to me. Well, maybe the limb's not all that sizable, but the bet is. You've written in the National Interest that North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons. Walk us through why you think so, when so many of us are deeply skeptical of that.
Well, if you look at what the North Korean position is, or even the South Koreans, who are not very helpful, yeah, they of course don't want to give up their nukes, and the South Koreans will help them not give up their nukes. But this is not a Kim question or a Moon Jae-in question. This is a Trump question. And the reason why I said that North Korea can give up its nukes and will give up its nukes is because our president will force them to. The United States has the leverage to force North Korea to give up its most destructive weapons. We can do that with force, and we can do that short of the use of force. And I've always said that this is a Trump question, whether President Trump is willing to exercise American national power to utilize all the elements of our power to force the North Koreans to do what they don't want to do. So I do believe that the North Koreans will give up their weapons because Trump will force them to. If I'm reading our president wrong, then the answer to that changes. But I do think that, especially with John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, we're seeing a very different attitude in Washington, and that they will push the president in the right direction.
Gordon, let me ask you to crystal ball gaze a little bit. The president, as we're speaking, is mulling the decision that he has said he will make by the end of this week about whether to perpetuate American participation in this so-called joint comprehensive plan of action with North Korea's strategic partner, Iran. He has been importuned to continue by various European leaders. Boris Johnson from the United Kingdom, their foreign minister, is in town this week for that purpose. What is your sense of how all of that looks from Pyongyang? What do you make of their reading of what is perhaps going to be the end of this deal with the Iranians and where things go from there?
Because the Iranian and the North Korean nuclear weapons program are joined together, some people say, with only a little bit of exaggeration, that it's one program in two separate locations. Because they're so closely connected, the North Koreans are going to take home a big message. And the question is what that message is. You have a lot of people saying that Kim is going to be less likely to come to a deal with the United States because we're breaking our deal with Iran. That's possible. But it's also possible, and I think actually more likely, that Kim will understand that our president is willing to use that American power I just talked about, that he won't be deceived by the Iranians, and that therefore he does need to come to terms with the United States and the international community. So, Frank, I'm saying that, look, there's a lot that we do not know. We can't say with confidence how Kim Jong-un will look at our actions on Iran, but it could very well be a beneficial effect as well as, you know, the deleterious effect that everyone is so confidently predicting.
Gordon, as always, you have given us a lot to chew on. Thank you so much for your time today, as always, for joining us. We'll look forward to talking with you next week. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.